This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We have two guests during this hour, Miles David Moore and Judith Harris. First of all, we're going to hear the poetry and meet Judith. Here's Judith Harris.
Last poem in May. After the late spring storm, the downed roses lower their faces, grazing in the wild grass. Nervous mourning doves circle the veranda, chittering bird songs, blowing out their white puffs of seed like ashes from a low fire. The loam turns black and gold, and black again. Stones hobble in place. The bushes gleam vigorously intact, like menaced buildings still standing. For each of us, there is a place we dare not enter, lest we trust the other has been there too. Mm. The star-shaped flowers splay backwards, aiming their hoary cacti at the sun. This is why the dead never come back, because they want us to believe they are this happy.
Oh, Judith, you draw us in and in and in. That was Judith Harris. I'm Grace Cavalieri. She has her doctorate, and her dissertation was The Darkness of Encounter, the figure of Psyche in Romantic Literature. And she is a poet that was recently nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. So, you know, we're going to hear some material that we won't forget in a hurry. And before we go into her work, we want to hear more of it. This is Judith.
I'm going to read a very new poem, which I think is representative of a kind of change in my work, and then go back to the volume, The Bad Secret. This is a new poem called Talking to You. I couldn't find a single way to explain the afterlife. It would be a repetition of joy on earth, everlasting. It would be the way I talk to you when my voice quivers as if it had form, a wave in ripples blunted by the shoreline. This is the way seeds burn beyond themselves, how roots travel and combust into flowers. An afterlife. Tell me the moment it blooms, and I will tell you the difference between happiness and sorrow.
Oh, Judith. Those are new poems?
Yes.
Her books are Atonement, Poppies, Song of the Moon. Those are old books. Yes. Most recently, we have Signifying Pain, Constructing and Healing the Self Through Writing, and then finally, The Bad Secret. That's from LSU Press. And we have a new book now, which is titled what?
Oh, I don't know yet.
Oh, you don't know yet. So we're getting some premieres today. But The Bad Secret is one of the most perfectly organized books I have ever read. It is in whoever the editor was, or maybe you did it yourself, but the tone from poem to poem is like a ribbon.
I hope the next one results
that way. And this is The Bad Secret you're holding in your hand. What is The Bad Secret, the philosophical underpinning?
What an interesting question. I think that The Bad Secret is the same as Original Sin. I think it is that part of us that we know, particularly in times in which we are solitary, and I spent a lot of time being solitary through the writing of this book, which was written very quickly. I think it was written within 6 months.
Wow.
And I think that that is one of the reasons why the book holds together.
It is all of one piece. It actually is more a time and space piece than a collection.
Yes.
So we'll go into that. This is Judith Harris. We're at the Library of Congress.
One of the things that I've been very interested in is the movement of confessionalism, both historically and as an aesthetic movement, which I think has been much misunderstood by belated poets looking back on Plath and Sexton and misconstruing some aspects of what they were trying to do with guilt or sin or revelation. And then there, and I am a strong defender of confessionalism or neo-confessionalism, using the past to locate through art exigent moments of pain, and when outrage must marry music, we have the lyricism. The bad secret. In my parents' bedroom, the hump of my father's belly sucked in its breath. He was a whale and an island, body hair like tropical palm trees, balls carved into coconuts or shrunken heads. His loud snore like sonogram waves in a tight submarine. Oh, we were deep, shelves under. I could recite each plateau going down as a knife, digging into the furnace of the earth, that golden seed inside the heart of the planet, where the dead go when they are no longer bodies, where the dead go when they have just had enough.
Let's have another.
The family poems, I have about three themes I recycle through: nature, childhood, death. This is called A Snapshot of My Sister and Me, My First Birthday. This is all I have of us, the black and white Polaroid, limp and crackled and aged. We are sitting on the microscopic grass. Our dresses are homemade. You are 5 years old, wearing barrettes, your hair newly grown, and you have a sailor's collar. I am looking elsewhere. In the background, the dark houses with their white shingles and monotonous brick have forgotten us. You are pushing me forward. Already the picture is disintegrating. It is so fragile that some of our flesh has worn off.
This is Judith Harris. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. What do you set right in writing your poetry? I have the feeling you're always setting something right.
How beautifully put. I am trying to set right in the way that I think that the confessional poets wanted to set right through bringing forth material that is taboo, controversial, which really tears the skin off, but to do it with such beauty, or to try to do it with such beauty, that it becomes, I think, a schoolyard for emotions.
Oh, this is so interesting.
Us how to have emotions and how to resolve the bitterness of painful things.
This is so interesting to hear you articulate, because when you read your poetry, the girls are in their little tulle dresses, they're in their ballet slippers, they're in their little sparkly barrettes, but there's something so scary underneath those costumes, that each poem is a performance.
Yes.
And I think that that is a new face you've put on confessional poetry. In, although there's an I message, you really have made each one a tiny performance, which is something quite different from what Anne Sexton did. She harked back to fairy tale and mythology,
right.
But you really put on a little play each time, and we're terrified.
Thank you. And this poem works perfectly in our conversation, because I wrote it explicitly for my friends Linda McCarriston and Maxine Skates, who write poems about domestic abuse and some seriously alarming events in childhood, and Dorian Lau. So I decided to write a poem for us. And this is called, and I sent it to them, and this is called First Halloween, 1962. Our yard was a floating carpet of oak and maple leaves, the empty swings swaying from their chains. I wanted to be a bride for Halloween, so my mother clumsily stitched a costume out of one of her old negligees, one with pearls and ruffles and a flimsy hook. So I went door to door, crackling through the weeds, with my bogus gown still stained with the sperm of my father's own seed, never to guess that one day this could be poetry.
Thank you. Judith has studied at the University of Maryland, beginning first in English and Studio Arts, going then to Brown University, where she majored in creative writing and American poetry and got her advanced degree there, and finally became a doctor of philosophy in the field of English and American literature. I think she is one of the most important women poets writing today. I think she follows in the trail of Louise Glick, and I believe that she is taking the unknown and making it possible, making it germinate, making it tolerable. She's very active in the psychoanalytic community as well in her scholarship and her poetry, which cross over. But I wouldn't even like to take one more minute away from you. So here's Judith.
I'm going to move to new work, as we've talked about the confessional aspect. And now I think what I've done is move the confessional aspect to the garden, back to nature. Pardon. Although there is no blatant sin in the garden, there have been trespassers. Pardon their feet for wandering. Pardon the squabs of grass, the squirrel's nest in the bare poplar in the shape of a bearded head. Pardon the rasping leaves, the rose captured in their thorny prison vines, the red spider mites and old offenses of the weeds. Pardon them as believers of another faith. Unbolt their chains and lift up their blindfolds. Show them how mercy is divine.
How did you approach that? How did you decide to make that a blessing? How did you decide that? Just feel good one day? What was that approach?
I think that it's just as you said, setting things right, that my process and is a process of continually looking outside of a window, looking, waiting for the natural world to speak. And that's how I've trained myself for 20 years in listening, and speaking. And there was something about, I think I was actually thinking about the Iraq War and the idea of extending the idea of political parity. What if it were true in our natural world to invert the myth of Eden, instead of needing a divine to pardon us for what we did in Eden, let's pardon Eden itself.
Oh, wow. Have you written on that critically?
No, but I think I will.
I think so. I think there's a bunch of essays coming out of this. But interesting that the natural world informs you, your psychological world. I think that's very interesting.
Yes, and it's a caricatured natural world, which has been sometimes troubling to me, because I'm not a naturalist. I approach the natural world, and I've studied Stevens and the Pathetic Fallacy, and I approach it as a reflection and a projection of my own state of mind, but I have enough negative capability to believe in the time of composition that I am learning what I need to know, which is not botany. It's something else.
Out of that world that we all look at. Yeah. Well, let us go on. This is a new book we're hearing. No one else has heard it before. It is Judith Harris, who is picking up the mantle for women in poetry.
That's right.
And taking it from Leonie Adams, taking it from our early laureates, carrying it forward with a new sensibility. And I'm so glad to be coming along with her. So here she is. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress.
This is different, and especially would want to do it here so that you could hear it, Grace, because it makes people laugh. And I do write funny poems whenever I can. This is a poem which I was initially entitled Multiculturalism, but then I changed it to Crayons. It is about the Crayola boxes that we used to get as children, and they're still making them, but when they became the jumbo size and they put them all together. So this is a description of crayons. They came in a box that was yellow as a school bus. They were orphans. Some never touched. They sang from the stacked pews. The golds and silvers sat up front like boys in the choir. They took burnt sienna to the woodshed, copper fried in a pan like a fish. Midnight blue rode a boat, and lemon lime blazed like a sun. I never spoke to them out loud, but sometimes I took them out of their orphanage and spread them out on the carpet under my canopy bed, waiting for the world to match them like slipcovers to paint. One by one, they were adopted. The pincushion chose red, the kettle chose black, the floorboard chose ochre, and my corduroy first day at school dress took magenta. Flesh kiss flesh. They rolled in joy and lost their important points. They scrolled on papers and made up homes on envelopes. At night, I imagined them cupping their breath like candles, sent to color up the cardboard heaven. And when day was done, each one sighed and lay down in a different coffin of grass.
What is the question that you're leaving us with?
It's actually a poem that was inspired by Blake, by the Songs of Innocence and Experience, that the chimney sweeper poems, in which the idea of equality here, the crayons being, everyone loved the golds and the metals and didn't like burnt sienna. But in the end, they all, even in their resurrection, lie down in the simple.
Well, that's what the writer thinks. The reader comes away from your work and with always a magnificent question, and that's how I gauge poetry.
Yes.
And this is, once more, I mean, there is so much innocence here and so much danger in that, because yes, innocence is always a return. It's never a beginning. So you know something's happened before this and
that's
something's going to happen afterwards.
You've got it. That's
and,
what Blake said.
That's what I think why your poetry is multidimensional and what is, may have interested the Pulitzer Committee most is that we are always left with a more than a resonance, a question.
Oh, how wonderful.
And here's Judith, and I'm Grace.
I think I'm going to read one that does end with a question for your granddaughter.
Well, you do know what I mean, that some you end
yes
with a question mark, and you have an actual declarative,
know,
and one is the center of the volcano.
Thank you. This one leads with a question, and as the other poet was talking about return to metrics, this is my return to metrics. Meter making. In the late afternoon, the green bottle tree is jam-packed with leaves, its trunk spouting like a fountain's head. I see the quick burnish of sparrows bedecked with radiant source, red-flecked bobbers drawn to upper stories? What sends them to my window only to sweep them away, deposits of another world pinched with a bristle? What rights they have, what enunciated wings? What makes them settle again and again, blue husked and identical on my neighbor's branch, like stress on a syllable?
Judith, I'm looking at this pile of poems, and I'm really envious. You have a lot of work done. You have done so much work. I am really in awe of the tonnage I'm looking at. What is the hardest part of all you do?
I think that the beginnings are always the hardest for me. The beginnings, the openings, and satisfying all of the critics in my mind about approach. Because recently I've been thinking about voice, that voice, I never felt that voice was something that one would rely on consistently in a poem. But in the end, a voice is.
And what is voice?
Voice for me is a culmination. It isn't simply thinking in one's own mind and overhearing in one's own mind a voice that is carrying the weight of the poem, but rather it is the combination of the voice, kind of like object relation theories, of the voice saturated in some objects, some object thing, which changes it.
Well, if I read your work from beginning to end, and I have read some of every book, the voice I get is that just no one else, just to put it on the kindergarten level, just no one else sounds like you. I mean, I would know you in the middle of the New Yorker without your name on the bottom. How we achieve that, I'm not sure. I guess it's subject, tone, diction, whatever we can. But you have a voice, and you know it, and it's like nobody else's. Are you aware of that?
No, but what I associate with that is that it's flaw. If you have enough elements in making the pie, the flaw in the pie will make it the one that is recognizable.
Oh, wow. I heard of that.
I know. This is called Bear. B-I-E-R. So many things carried inside it. Think of all the things that wish to be carried. The inside of the charred bark, the inside of a carcass or stone. All weight comes to an end. We know that. We know it by the stars that are so heavy they burn themselves alive. By the time we see them, they are dark as tombs. By the time we see them, we are inside, too. Singing at sunrise. There you are, firm blue jay, solo of morning, first to perch upon a thistle of the gold-green fern as the sun clamps down, and you warbling that imperious song, prodding the other birds to brood and pipe, turning all to gold and too much gold, a Midas bird in his retiring nest, singing everything gold, the rotting mold and sedge and starched out plants, the pauper sun half shrunk by afternoon, making more of less and less of more.
Judith, may I say that it is too simplistic, but everything you've gone through has been worth it.
That's what my daughter says. That's what my daughter says.
Thank you. So let us have a final poem.
Okay. It's been wonderful to be able to read the new poems.
Well, it's going to be wonderful to buy the new poems. Also, when we listen to this next poem, I'm going to ask the audience to hear how craft figures in as the pressure in the poem.
Thank you.
Because that's where you get your hydraulics.
Right.
So let us have a final poem.
Okay. This is called Lumpectomy Scar. dealing with a difficult subject and someone who you and I are both very fond of, Ted Kooser. Well, I'll tell you a little bit more about what he had suggested about this poem, which I never did change because it had been accepted for publication and the editor liked it a different way. But this is called Lumpectomy Scar. It looks like a fishbone or a railroad track, a pinkish horseshoe or a sunset fading into the horizon. Over the years it has diminished, stitch by stitch, where the scalpel went in and they drew out the tumor, blinking like a White House. That thing, oh, blinking like a lighthouse.
You can start over again and read the whole poem if you want.
Okay. It looks like a fishbone or a railroad track, a pinkish horseshoe or a sunset fading into the horizon. Over the years, it has diminished, stitch by stitch, where the scalpel went in and they drew out the tumor, blinking like a lighthouse. That thing could have killed you, the pathologist said, after studying it under the microscope and dropping it with his tongs into a Gerber jar. Now it is only a braised line, a canceled letter, a rancher's brand on a calf's flank. Reflected in the mirror, I can even crack it into a smile. But don't believe me, it won't wash off on its own. The body was made to preserve it, like a soldier protecting a tomb.
That is the voice of Judith Harris, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We'll be right back. Back with Miles David Moore. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Miles Moore is a poet who has written several books, and tell me the book you're going to read from first.
Well, Grace, I'm going to read the very first poem from my very first book, The Bears of Paris, and this poem is called Two Men.
This is Miles.
Two men drive by a field with a horse, a tree, and a pond. What a beautiful horse, the first man says. The second man, driving, glances toward the horse. Awfully sway-backed, he answers. The first man is humbled and says nothing more. Only later, much later, does he realize it wasn't a horse he found beautiful, but a horse with a wind-blown mane, in a green field with a wind-blown tree and the sun scattering stars on a pond.
That's Miles David Moore. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And he is a poet of reconciliation and hope, which we will find out through this program, as well as irony and humor, too. If you were to say, if you were to teach that poem on the literal level, what would you say it was? Who did what to whom?
Well, I would say, Grace, that it's just a poem about differing perceptions of the same event. There's one person who's sitting observing the scene. The other is preoccupied with something else. And the two differing viewpoints, I mean, it's very easy in our society for the poetic viewpoint to be squashed by the literal viewpoint, which I think is probably the gist of the poem.
Let's have some more.
Okay. I'm going to do two poems now, two short poems that are differing views of childhood, two very contrasting views of childhood. One is based on a portrait in the Uffizi Gallery by Agnolo Bronzino. It's Portrait of the Infant Giovanni de' Medici. Fattened with latte, bomboloni, and the pride of his august parents, Il Bambino Principe smiles sweetly even when laced into a silk doublet and made to sit still for the nice painter. You would smile too, as sweetly and unreflectively as little Gianni, if your life were as brightly colored and docile as the bird he holds in his hand, something that will sing, but not fly away. The baby's mild, wide eyes see visions of groaning tables that stretch without end. His lips part, ready to eat again. Life is good. Life is easy. It will not get any harder. Then the second poem, which is from The Bears of Paris, concerns something I actually saw in an old McCrory's discount store years ago. I don't know if they still have McCrory's, but this is based on something I actually saw in the one in my neighborhood. This is called Plastic Hen. Between the gum and underwear displays, the purple plastic hen twirls on her dime store weather vane and squawks electrically for a quarter. She stoops on her glass nest to warm transparent eggs. Through tin mail slots, she doles her chicks. Bright whistles, rubber dinosaurs, fossil superheroes. One day, I saw a woman fish a quarter from a tattered purse. Her three-year-old compressed his face against the treasured glass. The hen awoke like Sleeping Beauty, clucked her purple polymeric song, and spun before the wide-eyed boy as if this were a wondrous world.
And it is. This is Miles Moore talking. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. And Miles has authored several books, The Bears of Paris, Buddha Isn't Laughing, Roller Coaster. He co-edited Winners, a retrospective of the Washington Prize, which was an anthology published by WordWorks, of which he is a prominent member and one of the pillars of our community. And he's been published in various reviews throughout the country, won several honors, which we will get to. He is also a technical writer, which I'm going to find out about how that coexists with the poetic soul. But first of all, Miles, tell me what you think is happening in your work now. I've been watching you for 30 years. And if you think work matures, where do you think you were and where do you think you are?
Well, Grace, I think my early poetry was largely, well, first of all, just trying to articulate some things that were going on in my life. I think that's where everybody starts out. You just start out with the facts of your own life, and you also start out imitating the poets whom you admire.
Who was that?
Well, so many. When I was a kid, I had access, like, my uncle had an old college textbook called The Book of Living Verse. It was an old Louis Untermeyer anthology, and it was literally from the old anonymous ballads to, it was published in 1945, the latest poet they had, and it was Stephen Spender. But that's where I was first introduced to the work of Shakespeare, Milton, Blake, Keats, Yeats, Frost. All of those poets were very important to me.
That's the ancestry, and that is the legacy. So let us go on to Miles.
Okay.
We're at the Library of Congress with Miles David Moore.
Okay, well, I mentioned that I was working out certain things about my life when I started out, and that's where the character Fatslug came from, who is can be described as the poster boy for the low self-esteem society. And I think Fatslug, the Fatslug poems are poems of disconnections, both the times when you think you're communicating with people but you really aren't, or when you are communicating, only they aren't listening. And it happens to everybody. That I try to make him sort of an everyman. And his, I'm going to read two Fatslug poems. This first one, you know, all the poems have sort of a surrealistic tinge. This one definitely does. This is called Fatslug on Ice. It's the Olympic skating finals, Fatslug. Never mind you've never skated before. Never mind you were brought here under false pretenses. Never mind your hands are tied behind your back and you're wearing roller skates. The spotlight shines on you, Fat Slug. The program calls for you to begin with a triple Thalcow and double Lutz, whatever those are. The friends who told you this was just for fun are the judges. They sit immovable as Aku Aku, lights refracting from their glasses like sun from glaciers, pencils sharpened to stiletto points. The crowd is sending up a chant which is either Fat Slug, Fat Slug, Fat Slug, or something far less pleasant. The judges, with ostentatious flourishes, write 0.0 before you even move. The flight of the bumblebee squawks through the PA system as you take your first step and fall full forward to meet your old friend Ice.
Oh, Miles, so much happens there to all of us. But yeah. I remember you being on a winning slam team or something going across country. Did I imagine that? I thought you were part of the Washington, D.C.
I was. With- and in fact, the Fat Slug poems were some of those that I read. And in fact, the one I'm just about to read is but one that I read.
I'm looking at this pristine resume of yours, and nowhere does it say Fat Slug. Are you afraid to put it on your vita?
Well, you know.
You were a winner. DC was, I think, the national champion that year.
Actually, it was 6th out of 24, but Sylvana Straw and Jeffrey McDaniel both placed very highly. I think they were like 2nd and 3rd.
And DJ Renegade.
No, DJ was the next year, okay. You know.
But Fat Slug was there.
Fat Slug was
right,
there.
Let's
and,
go
you know,
on.
Fat Slug has his victories. I mean, he does. I mean, he has to admit it. It's, you know, it's just that I think Fat Slug feels more deeply the disconnects of life and the. He usually thinks they're his fault. But you know, but anyway, here's Fat Slug's meetings with people tend to be on the surrealistic side. And in this one, Fat Slug meets a poet. He materializes from the camouflage of President's Park and weaves around the Treasury Building's wrought iron fence, his sneakers kicking a soft drink cup. A ponytail trickles from the back of his helmet and down his battle fatigues. His knapsack has a ponytail, too, fluorescent orange cord dangling to the sidewalk. Freak alert! Freak alert! Fat Slug shifts into warp speed to get past this idiot, but as he racewalks by, Fat Slug sees an unsteady finger pointing at him and hears a voice. Before you go, I want you to know that the man behind you is the Death Crow, and the man behind him is the Life Flow, and the man behind him is the Hedgerow, and the man behind him is the Rainbow, and the man behind him is the Free Throw, and the man behind him is the Late Show, and the man behind him is the Stooge Mo, and the man behind him is Ohio. Remember this. Go slow.
Miles Moore, and I want you to know he's going right from here to a very dignified office where they do not allow this exhibition. So he's getting it out of his system right now. We love Fat Slug so much. He represents all of us. You can't win the anti-hero. But it's more than that, isn't it, in our culture? It's more about being menaced by authority in some way.
Yeah, well, being menaced by authority and also, I think, the fear of being thought as odd or out of place, or somehow offensive. I mean, from our earliest childhood, you know, we want to fit in. We want to be thought of as part of the group. And now, later on, as you mature, you might learn that somehow being part of the group isn't all it's cracked up to be. That somehow you need to think for yourself. That you need to diverge from what the crowd thinks. But the pressure in society is so great, and I think we all fear the faux pas.
But here
of
you
society.
Have the judges who's of the ice skating contest, the judges saying it doesn't matter what you do, and they're the judges. I think that that is where you capture the brilliant, vital, bright irony of our culture.
I think that's the fear. The fix is in. But,
that is it. The fix is in.
Yeah.
I'll just tell you a little bit who he is. He is from Ohio, and was a Jenny McKean Moore Scholar in Creative Writing at GW University. And he is also a member of the board of WordWorks, a Washington publishing house. He's read variously all over the country and has won the Sidney Sulkin Prize, the Poetry Prize for the Potomac Review, the Rose Lefkowitz Prize, the Best of Issue Prize for Word Rights, the Crane Award for Excellence in Journalism, where he is a Washington reporter for Rubber and Plastic News and assistant editor for Rubber and Plastic News. Just in one sentence, how's Rubber doing?
Well, it's bouncing along.
I'm sorry I asked. Let's go right into that poem.
Okay.
Here's Miles.
Okay, well, very good. I've been writing a lot more formal poetry recently. This is the one that was most recently published in Measure out of the University of Evansville. And I guess you could say this is a poem about how we like to destroy our own history. This is called A Vandalized Churchyard. The headstones that withstood a thousand storms and snows slant broken in the mud like fallen dominoes. And that's the way it goes. Why should we make a fuss about some shattered stone? To be anonymous, unheeded, and alone is the one truth we've known. So do the dead deserve the dignity of name? Time throws all life a curve. It's just a children's game, from age to age the same. Children must have play before they go to bed. They run an ancient way where those now ashes led to unname all the dead.
Mm. The beautiful form of that one, the beautiful inner rhyme, that's something you're working on, which I haven't seen throughout your work.
Well, it's something that I've worked on off and on. I've always greatly admired the formal poets.
Here he is. We're at the Library of Congress together, Miles David Moore, who is a beloved poet in Washington, D.C., as well as elsewhere. And here he talks to us again.
Okay. I'll read you a sonnet next. This is a sonnet that uses one of Alfred Hitchcock's most famous movies as its source. This is called Vertigo. Here are the stairs you always knew you'd climb. Your pale blonde obsession waits above, her cigarette your only light. It's time, the tower bells ring, to rise and claim your love. But is this a MacGuffin or what's true? The staircase stinks of mold, the old steps groan under your heft. It all comes back to you, what you must do, have always done, alone. You've made it to the edge. Stern redwood trees cluster below, and a nefarious plan of gods grow rings around your waking dreams. The sight amazes even you. The ease with which you fall is timeless. The blonde screams to see this hurtling void shaped like a man.
Wow. Which is that book?
It's Roller Coaster. It's my third book, my second full-length book. Both of my full-length books were published by the Word Works.
And that's the Capital Collection.
That is the Capital Collection, recently renamed the Hillary Tom Capital Collection in honor of a poet who was a great inspiration to me, and I know to you too, Grace. But
I dreamed about her this week.
Oh, wow.
So she must be here today.
I would certainly
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
So. I always feel her presence in the room whenever I'm doing anything about poetry.
And that speaks of the community of poets. I don't wish to be maudlin about that, but there is a heart connection with poets that is bigger than hanging out together or just publishing and reading each other's works and promoting each other. And it is something that is a sisterhood and brotherhood that lasts beyond us, really.
And that's true. And that's one thing I've always been grateful for, particularly in the Washington, D.C. poetry community, is that it really is a band of brothers and sisters. Stylistic differences and aesthetic quarrels have never been a huge part of the D.C. scene, as I understand they have been in other cities. Here, I think we really do hang together, because I think we realize we'll hang separately otherwise.
Well, it's an honor to have you honor the quirkiness of life with your poetry. So here go. Let's go.
I've been trying to write about my own life recently, and in particular, I've been writing some poems about my parents. You know, my father died a few years ago. My mother is now in assisted living, and I find myself thinking about them a great deal, how much I owe them. I was extremely lucky. I won the lottery of life in my parents. I mean, they were the most wonderful people. And these are two poems. This first one is about has to do with my father's death. And this is, this was the day of his burial. This is called The Horse. Barely a yearling, the horse parts the high grass to meet us at the fence that separates the meadow from the graveyard. Snuffling the wire mesh, he waits patiently for us to admire him and stroke his palomino muzzle. We, who have just left the ashes of husband, father, grandfather, are weary of farewells and turn slowly away. When we leave the horse, he whinnies, a sound as lonely as a winter midnight. 2 months later, I return to mown grass, a distant house, and cows. The flags on the grave snap like whips in the wind that canters along the fence and nickers in the trees. And this is a poem about my mother, who served as an army nurse during World War II. You know, I was 12 years old before I realized that not all of my friends had both parents in World War II. My father fought at Okinawa. My mother was in an evac unit attached to Patton's Third Army. But this is a poem about my mother's, it's both her World War II experiences and her current life. This is called The Good Fight. The English Channel surged below you, its waves licking American bones. It was D-Day plus 50, Utah Beach, and all 5'3" of you with 1,000 other nurses, helmeted, full field packed, clambered down the rope ladder swaying against the ship. The transports were children's toys bobbing below. "Don't look down, don't slip," your commanders told you. "Your pack will drag you straight to the bottom." The Norman fields boomed in the distance as the waves moaned their hunger. 60 summers distant from France, the explosion was in your brain. You take lessons on how to lace a shoe, how to walk with a cane. Your voice, musical as always, lilts over the nursing center's phone. "Honey, I'm going home today. Can you call my mom and dad and tell them to come get me?" Mother, you ascend a ladder now. The sky is hazy above you, a fog of dreams and memories. The decades are your backpack now. Please don't look down. Please don't slip. You fight the good fight, now as then. Oh, Mommy, please climb.
Whoa. The Good Fight. Could that be a book? Because we don't have the memory of women in World War II. And she must have told you anecdotes.
Well, you know, neither my father nor my mother really liked to talk very much about their experiences. You know, they were, in both cases, quite horrific. I mean, my mother saw the casualties from some of the worst battles of the war, and my father fought in some of the worst battles of the war. And, Mom did tell me a few anecdotes, but I think it was fairly typical for people who were veterans of World War II to be pretty reticent about what they...
Now in her does she have dementia?
She has Alzheimer's-like dementia.
Does she return to the past or not?
Yes, yes, she does, but she doesn't really talk very much about the war. She, I think, prefers to talk about the more pleasant things of her, thinks about more about the more pleasant things of her past. I mean, she can, there's a picture of my father and my mother that was taken in 1942, and actually it was taken about a block from where I work right now. My father was stationed in Washington. My mother was visiting him. This was before she entered the Army. But my mom can look at that. It's a black and white photo, but she can tell you exactly the color of her dress, the color of the purse she was carrying, you know, like what sort of day it was, what the guy looked like who took the photo. He was just a street photo, street photographer who just happened to snap the picture. They almost didn't buy the picture, but my mom insisted. Oh. And now all of my three sisters and I all have copies of that picture. It's a family heirloom.
These are crucial moments you write about. And
one of these days I'll write a poem about that. It just hasn't come out yet.
Well, if you just said it, you know, the way you said it here, and just tell the story, because, as I say, crucial moments should not be lost, can be made permanent. And this is Miles Moore doing just that, and we're at the Library of Congress, so let's hear another.
Okay, very good. I sometimes write political poetry, and I have very strong political beliefs, but my poems sometimes tend to be political commentary from hindsight. I like to write about poems from history, and particularly, but I find myself writing about some of the injustices of history that will never be righted. This is a poem, this is such a poem. This is called The Victory of Joseph Stalin, and the epigraph is March 5th, 1953, which was the day Stalin died. The atheist God prepares to lie in state, eternal as the Kremlin. Dumb with awe, his angels keep their distance, grovel, wait. A dying tiger still wields fang and claw. He has no earthly rivals. Peasants pray to Lenin's mannequin, and Mexican revelers dance gaily on their day of death with Trotsky's cleavage skeleton. He dies the cynosure of common folk, an eastern sun emitting westward rays, while tail gunners shoot their own, a skulk of little foxes yelp unending praise. All revolutions eat their young, but he is old, was always old. There is no why to power, just a how. Serenity in signing orders that the young must die, and faith in nothing but the voiceless cold expanse of enemies serenely killed. Mandelstam, Tukhachevsky, Meyerhold. The Tower of Babel is forever stilled. The will to win is all there is on earth, and death is just an everlasting hole, so he decreed. But in the shit-stained birth of all his heirs lies his immortal soul. Like him, his children write their names in blood across the booming homelands of the dead. They learned from him the one eternal good, to die omnipotent in one's own bed.
The poem as investigation, and now a final one.
Okay. This is a book from the Bears, a poem from the Bears of Paris, and this is probably one of my great recital pieces. I do it probably 90% of the readings I do. It's based on a piece of graffiti that was on a decrepit old supermarket wall in Arlington. It was torn down. The supermarket was torn down, but I felt I should commemorate the graffiti, which says, "I love Barbie Taylor, T-Mac." It's official now. T-Mac no longer loves Barbie Taylor. Not for the commuters on I-395 who for 8,000 yesterdays read Passion and 3-foot schoolboy script. Today the bulldozers came, and romantic words became rubble, to be cleared away for the ritual mating of asphalt and earth. But what of real love? Did Barbie and Tease live past demolition, or die long before it? Did Tease love leave the wall? Was Barbie's ever there? when Barbie laid azure or emerald or onyx eyes on T's declaration? Did she roll them in ecstasy or embarrassment? Did Barbie and T find out too late that love can squall and soil itself, or wither in a stranger's wink, or survive the fatal screech of cars against each other? Or did Barbie and T, a couple not perfect but comfortable with their familiarity, see their wall come down with a pang for youth so long gone, so shortly gone, hold hands for the millionth time, and wave at T. Jr. walking with his first girlfriend? If the earth has an answer, the dozers drown it out. Their burring voices shake the overpass where Todd Loves Tiffany appeared last week, and echo in the park, rustling the oak tree where Isaac has loved Maud 100 years.
Those are the poetry reports from Miles David Moore, and that was the voice of Miles. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the library for its services. The Poet and the Poem is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-productions by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.